I want to try something a little out of the box just for a second. One of the things we talk about is the value of your gut. And from time to time, all of us have to take some antibiotics for one reason or another. How do we bring our gut back in balance after we've taken antibiotics?
That's a good question. By the way, a quick shout out to my co-author, Mark Bittman, who needs no introduction, I'm sure. But I wrote How to Eat with Mark, and I brought the nutrition knowledge to the table, but Mark really has this expansive knowledge of the whole foodscape, and it was really a privilege to collaborate with him. So, there's more and more public discourse, more and more scientific inquiry, more and more awareness about the critical importance of our gut, because what we're really talking about is not just the cells that line our gastrointestinal tract or how important that organ system is, but the microbiome. Most of it lives there. A lot of it lives throughout our bodies, on our skin, other parts of us, but most of it lives in the gut. And it's just incredibly important because metabolites generated by the microbiome circulate throughout our bodies, influence our hormone levels, influence inflammation, immune system response, vascular health, and so forth. So the microbiome is incredibly important. And unfortunately, antibiotics are a form of chemical warfare that doesn't really differentiate between friend and foe. So the bacteria that are responsible for helping us thrive are wiped out along with bad guys. One of the things you try to do in medicine is be very judicious about use of antibiotics. First of all, don't use them when you don't need them. They're overused. And second, use the one with the narrowest spectrum so you don't kill off any of the friendly bugs you don't have to kill off. But as you say, Larry, inevitably after a course of antibiotics, there's been disruption to the microbiome. And I would make a very simple recommendation. Following a course of antibiotics, a course of probiotics. And probiotics are ingestible bacteria. Many of them need to be refrigerated to maintain high quality counts, but they don't all need to be refrigerated. I take one myself called Peptiva. I can keep it at my bedside table. It's stable at room temperature. You want one that guarantees high colony counts. Generally, you want one with a diversity of strains. But essentially, you're replacing the good, commensal, helpful bacteria that were wiped out by the antibiotic and helping to repopulate your gut. I think that makes sense. And to be clear, you're right. There is the acute damage if you are prescribed antibiotics. I think there's a case for probiotics pretty generally, though, because we wind up being exposed to antibiotics in our food supply. The levels are less, but we all have some exposure. So just living in the modern world is pretty hard on the microbiome. And when it's studied, we find that people living in modern countries tend not to have the optimal distribution of bacteria. So I generally recommend a probiotic.
Okay. In your book, you talk about eggs a little bit. What you mention is that eggs, you're sort of neutral on it. In some cases, as you say, it improves diet. In other cases, in an all plant-based diet, it worsens diet. But you said on balance, it matters what you replace eggs with. And I guess what I just wanted to comment something that my father had told me. He was a cardiologist. I asked him, can I have eggs for breakfast? He said, sure. Do me a favor. Why don't you have three eggs but two yolks? Let's increase the relative amount of egg whites relative to the yolk. He said, I understand the yolk tastes delicious, but there's a limitation on how much saturated fat and cholesterol I want you to have for breakfast. What are your thoughts on combining, I'll call it more egg whites in your combination of your eggs?
By the way, my dad's a cardiologist too, so we probably heard many of the same messages growing up. So, first, at the high-level issue, Larry, as you say, eggs are good, eggs are bad, dairy is good, dairy is bad, this is good, that grains are good, grains are bad. All of this is subject to the instead of what stipulation. And that is routinely ignored both in the science. So studies fail to ask the question, what was replaced when we asked people to eat more eggs or anything else? What was bumped out of the diet? And how did it reverberate through the diet? Because, putting a food in or taking a food out is like tossing a pebble in a pond. It changes the overall composition of the diet. So where did you start and where did you land? That's crucial for eggs and everything else. In general, the thinking about cholesterol and really, egg yolk is a highly concentrated source of cholesterol, but a fairly negligible source of saturated fat. We get a lot of our saturated fat from meat and dairy. We get relatively little of it from eggs. So the question then becomes, you know, how important is dietary cholesterol? Dietary cholesterol is measured in milligrams. Our intake of fats is measured in grams. That's a, you know, three orders of magnitude difference. And it does make a huge difference in terms of the impact on our blood levels of cholesterol. So saturated fat is much more impactful than cholesterol. And as a result of that, really good scientists, including some close friends of mine who were involved in the 2015 Dietary Guidelines Advisory Committee for the United States, said, you know, we can stop telling people to worry about dietary cholesterol, because when they get other things right, it's unimportant. And if they don't get other things right, the other things are so much more important than cholesterol, it's really just a distraction. So it kind of dropped out of the official recommendations. I was okay with that. But I was okay with that principally because our diets are pretty crummy to begin with. And in the context of a really bad baseline diet, and that is the typical American diet, cholesterol is the least of our worries. We have much more to worry about from fatty meats, high intake of sodium, saturated fat, added sugar. And so it's, you know, essentially it's just, yeah, it's not good for you, but it's too small a problem to focus on. We've got, as the saying goes, bigger fish to fry. The other thing I'd note, just very quickly, is, and Mark and I emphasize this in the book, I think we should all be looking at optimal diet through three lenses, not just one. So the one we're talking about is what is directly good for human health. And as a physician, that's always been what matters to me. But as I stated at the start, diet has a massive influence on planetary health. And, you know, whether or not we cut down the rainforest in the Amazon to graze cattle so we can eat more meat, or raise the rainforest in Borneo for more palm plantations so we can eat more processed foods with palm oil. So we really do need to be thinking about the impact of our dietary patterns at scale. And animal foods in general, including eggs, tend to have a much greater environmental footprint than plant foods. And then there's finally the issue of, you know, decency, ethics, how we treat other animals. If you're going to eat eggs, you know, whether you keep all the yolks or discard one, as per Larry's father, make sure you source them from a place where you know the hens are being treated decently, because in factory farms, that's not the case. And I don't think any decent person wants gratuitous cruelty on the menu.
I want to ask a question about your opening statement about 500,000 deaths from bad diet. You know, when they asked smokers how much life expectancy change was reduced because of smoking, my understanding is that smokers overemphasized the risk of death by many times. They thought smoking was much more dangerous than it was, and they continued to smoke. I'm wondering about this diet as well. If you take someone who is not overweight and who's doesn't have, I'll call it, one of the chronic diseases, how important is diet to a change in their expected loss of life? In other words, if you had someone, I'll call it a bad diet, say you would call it a red meat diet, and someone who has a plant-based diet, and both are generally healthy at the outset, what do you think the reduction in the total number of loss of life would be? Maybe with a mean and a standard deviation.
It's a really good question, because we're really good, and you know, I say this as a physician with 30 years of clinical practice, we're really good at forestalling death. And so I'd sort of turn it around and say 500,000 premature deaths, but premature just means, you know, dying before the full life expectancy in the United States, which before the pandemic was about 78 years. So if you die at 75, it's a premature death. And you know, frankly, because we have the capacity to live with vitality well into our 80s and 90s, it truly is a premature death. And many other countries have longer life expectancy. But the simple fact is, you know, people can have really advanced coronary artery disease and many complications of diabetes, and modern medicine is still pretty good at patching them back together so they don't die. And I've been involved in that for much of my career. What we can't do is restore vitality. I've always tended to think, Larry, and it's why I went on to train in preventive medicine after studying internal medicine. You know, I kind of had the impression I was being taught how to be one of the king's horses and one of the king's men. We could never put true vitality back together again. We were basically trying to unscramble an egg. So, you know, we prevented total calamity, but we didn't restore health. So, you know, I would say that the premature deaths generally are on the order of 3 to 5 years. I think that's highly significant, but it depends how bad the diet is, what you compare it to, you know, whether you're comparing to an optimal diet. So if you compare it to blue zone diets, for example, quickly for those who don't know, the blue zones are 5 places around the world described by National Geographic fellow Dan Buettner, where people routinely live to be 100. It's very common. And those who don't live to be 100 routinely live into their 90s. And they do it with vitality. They don't get chronic disease first. They don't get dementia. And we know that they all eat real food, not too much, mostly plants. If we set that as the benchmark and say that's the possible, because these are 5 very diverse populations. This is Ikaria, Greece, Sardinia, Italy, Okinawa, Japan, Loma Linda, California, and the Nicoya Peninsula in Costa Rica. These are not genetically alike. These are diverse populations who share elements of culture and lifestyle. So that suggests this is possible for all of us. If we were to say, you know, if we weren't living with the, you know, typical American seafood diet, I see food and I eat it, even if it glows in the dark, but if we were routinely physically active, got enough sleep, weren't stressed out, avoided toxins like tobacco, excess alcohol, and ate optimally, we would routinely live to be in our 90s to 100 without chronic disease. Well, then, you know, we're talking about 20 years of life lost. It's hard to give you a mean and standard deviation because I would have to push back and say, tell me what benchmark you want me to use. If we want to use life expectancy in the U.S., that's already dragged down by poor diet, poor lifestyle. If we want to use an example where people get diet and lifestyle right, then the loss is actually quite staggering. But even so, I would argue that the greater toll is not loss of years from life, it's loss of life from years. Because what kills you when you eat badly for a lifetime is not quick, it's slow, it's chronic disease. It's obesity leading to insulin resistance, leading to type 2 diabetes, leading to coronary disease, degradation of multiple organ systems, nerve damage, eye damage, brain damage. It's complications of dementia, which is generally insulin resistance of the brain and related to many of the same risk factors. It's cancer that takes years and even decades to develop, but is fueled by a bad diet that tips the immune system out of balance, and on it goes. So I don't think I can give you a mean and standard deviation because I don't really know what the reference standard ought to be. But if we compare ourselves to ourselves, it's several years. If we compare ourselves to the optimal, it may be a couple of decades. But even so, the greater toll is the loss of vitality over an extended period of time. And it's incredible how many Americans live with a burden of chronic disease. 6 in 10 American adults have at least one major chronic disease. 4 in 10 have 2 or more.
Hey, David, this is Todd. I have a question for you. Where do you think we are kind of in the slope of the curve? I mean, I look at things like, you know, the highly anticipated IPO of Oatly and the fact that Beyond Meat's got an $8 billion market cap, and there seems to be a lot of awareness around, at least in the financial community, about the potential of plant-based diets and plant-based foods and all those sorts of things. And I'm just wondering if that's just made, you know, kind of me being in my New York City bubble, or are we basically at a point where we're no longer getting worse and we may be on the precipice and there may be cause for optimism?
Yeah, well, great questions, Todd. And I think it's a bit of both. You know, there's more than one way to eat badly, and Americans seem committed to exploring them all. But maybe we're running out. And one of the reasons I'm optimistic is, you know, we've tried every cockamamie, silly, quick fix diet under the sun. At some point, you have to say, okay, you know, we can't really think of any more of those. I guess we just have to eat well, damn it. And I think there is this confluence of interest in human and planetary health. You know, I think a lot of what's driving innovation related to meat alternatives is conservation driven. You know, it's the notion, particularly among young people, millennials, that, you know, we're going to wind up in a world where there are no lions and tigers and bears. Oh my, are we really going to be okay with having done that? And if the answer is no, then, you know, we really need to do something about it. And we like the idea of doing judo rather than karate. In other words, you know, instead of arguing with people, you know, you want to eat meat but you can't, and then losing the battle, we'll say, okay, we'll create a meat alternative for you that satisfies your palate, gives you what you say you want, but eliminates the damage to the planet, and you know, maybe we can still have orangutans and tigers in the world and whales in the ocean. What do you think? Most people shrug their shoulders and say, I'll try it. If I like it, I'll join your team. So I kind of see the meat alternatives as a highly effective gateway drug. You know, I'm hoping that people move on to less processed versions of plant foods once they rehabilitate their taste buds. But I'm very much in favor, and I do think it's a significant indication of a confluence of multiple interests in our health, in the health of the planet, and a timely opportunity. We now have the technology to do that, and I think, you know, really clever people took advantage of the moment and they got it just right. I think it is significant. I think we're at a tipping point. I also think there's more interest in some fundamentals about food, eating clean, shorter ingredient lists. You know, I think there's more and more resonance with Michael Pollan's meme, eat food, not too much, mostly plants. That seems to be a recurring theme when I search for consumer trends. People are interested in clean eating. Now, they're still quite gullible and easily talked into nonsense. So, you know, the competition from fools and fanatics isn't going to go away anytime soon. But I am optimistic. I think things are improving. And, you know, I'm trying to be part of that solution. I left academia after 30 years, founded a company called Diet ID. And we're on a mission to make diet a vital sign. You know, there's an expression from the world of business. We don't tend to manage what we don't routinely measure. And I imagine nobody listening into this call has had a comprehensive diet assessment that told you, here's your diet quality, your diet type, your nutrient intake levels, because the tools are too onerous. So we built one that can do that in 60 seconds. It's easy. It's even fun. And we think then if everybody is alerted to what their diet is, and that's compared directly to what it could be, and they understand the value proposition, we can get a lot more people into the game. So, you know, I think there are many factors that tell us we're at or near a tipping point, and that encourages me.
I want to talk dairy for a second. In your book, you were moderately, slightly negative versus neutral on dairy, and the reason was saturated fat. And I just wanted to ask one question about Frankenfood and then one question about yogurt. So I have a protein shake, and I use a whey protein powder. My instinct is that you would call that Frankenfood and therefore should be removed from my diet. On the other hand, you don't mind dairy as long as it was not the saturated fat. How do you turn on protein powder, whey powder?
So I should be clear that I use Frankenfood, you know, maybe a bit glibly, you know, just to kind of castigate the array of willfully engineered addictive junk foods that Michael Moss writes about. And by the way, folks, another reference for you that I highly recommend, this was a New York Times Magazine cover story by Michael Moss, Pulitzer Prize winner. His book Hooked is just out. This was entitled The Extraordinary Science of Addictive Junk Food. If you haven't seen that, definitely recommend it. So this is not by accident. You know, essentially, the Frankenfoods I speak of, it's not just that they glow in the dark, but they've been designed by scientists using functional MRI machines to massively overstimulate the appetite center in the ventromedial hypothalamus of the human brain so that when they say, bet you can't eat just one, they can laugh about it all the way to the bank. You know, I mean, it's really a threat. So I mean those foods, and I don't specifically mean the addition of an isolated protein concentrate to make a smoothie or a shake. You know, it's not quite as pure as just, you know, eating whole foods. But I have advocated, I'm a public health pragmatist, and so throughout my career I've advocated that we not make perfect the enemy of good. And I think anytime we get overly dogmatic and, you know, you must eat one specific way and any transgression, you know, put out your hand so we can smack it with a ruler, I think that's a grave mistake. I'll be honest with you, Larry. I like corn chips and salsa, and there's no question about it. I mean, the corn chips have three ingredients. Usually it's whole grain corn, some kind of oil, and salt. But, you know, it's certainly not a whole food. But I really enjoy it. You know, I don't eat it every day, but periodically, corn chips, salsa, good beer. I mean, it's a terrific combination.
And bean dip or no bean dip?
Yeah, sure, bean dip too. And you know, the other thing we need to keep in mind, food should be a source of pleasure. Let me make a comment that may surprise you. I don't know that Mark and I said it quite this way in the book, but I have said it this way to my patients. We fail to think what health is for. Health takes on moral overtones, as if health is at the end of a, you know, physician's admonishing finger. You're a bad person if you're not a healthy person. That's nonsense. That completely misses the point of what health is for. Healthy people have more fun. The reason to care about your personal health is your life is better. Other things being equal, your life is better when you're healthy. So if the whole point of health is to have a better life, at some line that you're crossing, you say, yeah, but I'm giving up so much pleasure from the things I want to eat that the net effect on my quality of life is to reduce it. You know, I look at the combination of years in life, life in years, you know, there's some level of asceticism where I'm giving up more than I'm gaining. Don't do that. You are the boss. That's the sweet spot for all of us, where we optimize the pleasure we get from food. And it ought to be a source of pleasure when we have that luxury, as most of us here today do. Sadly, many people around the world don't. But when you have that opportunity, food should be a source of pleasure. Health should also be a source of pleasure. And what I advocate for is size up the two of them, maximize the sum, and live there. That's the place to be.
David, thank you very much.